You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Hilda O'Connell. Hilda, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Hilda, let's talk about, I suppose we'll talk about your path and a number of things, but to begin with, what are you working on at the moment?
Well, basically, I'm working on language. I got very interested in that quite a few years ago. I was working in many different styles, but I read something that Yeats said, that to create a relevant art, one must incorporate some idea of how the mind works. And then I thought about that, and then I thought when I was studying art history, my fascination was with illuminated manuscripts in the Middle Ages, especially the Celtic script and calligraphy. So I decided, well, that is really what I am interested in. So I began to explore language from the very beginning, prehistoric periods, all the way to today, and different kinds of languages, the calligraphy, the script, the design of it, and that interests me a great deal. The different societies, like it's interesting, like the Christianity, Judaism, and Islamic was out of Abraham. I never thought about that. So just looking at that kind of language, so this is what I've been preoccupied for quite a few years now.
I've always loved illuminated manuscripts myself. The Morgan Library is one of my favorite places to go to. So let's talk about how that's coming into your work. That's happening in recent oil and collage works, because I know there's letter forms in there.
I work spontaneously. It's a process that's extremely important. It's non-directed. In other words, I never start with a design. I start by scribbling or, putting strokes on the canvas, and the painting begins to emerge. And I use all kinds of techniques, mostly destructive techniques, but a lot of collage, different kind of images, tearing, scraping, overpainting, things like that. It's like an excavation. So I allow accident to be a big part of this. It's very important in the process, allowing new ideas to emerge out of the subconscious. And so that's basically how I work. I let the painting develop. Like, for instance, to be a painter, you've got to be a good parent. A parent doesn't dominate her child. And you can't dominate the painting. You've got to let it emerge, have its own life, and it speaks to you. So there is a dialogue with the material. And it's quite interesting. You get interesting effects you never even thought of doing. It just emerges.
Mm. I like the way you said that, because, of course, there is a dialogue, but also what it means to be a good parent in the work that you're doing, because you don't, as you say, sketch or plan or design beforehand. That also seems to equate with a child, right? We don't presume what a child will be or can be or try not to. And it seems to me that encourages the dialogue even more, right, with the work itself, in that you're
painting,
surprised by what you're getting.
The painting really speaks to you. One of the things I remember that was very important is something that de Kooning said, that be very careful about a great start in a painting. And what he means by that is when you start a painting and you've got some very interesting parts of it, you become paralyzed by it. It's a trap. Then you design around it, and you're killing the painting because you're losing the integrity of the painting. What you have to do is destroy it immediately. And the destruction is very, very painful. It's risk-taking. For instance, painting uses a dangerous life in a way. It's very different from writing. You can change a poem and go back to the original if you don't like the new line. In a painting, once you destroy a section of it, it's gone. You cannot go back to it. So you're taking a tremendous risk, and believe me, that risk is very painful, extremely painful. All these years I've gone through it. And sometimes when you destroy it, something marvelous emerges. Not always, but a lot of times it does. But you have to believe in yourself or have confidence in yourself to do it. And it takes courage, you know.
It does take courage. And since you mentioned William de Kooning, let's go back a little bit to, I think it was the late 50s when you moved to East 10th Street in East Village. Is that correct?
Yes.
Do you mind me asking before we get into that? Because I lived on East 10th Street for a while. Where on East 10th Street was that?
Oh, it was between 2nd and 3rd. No, 3rd and 4th.
Between 3rd and 4th, okay.
No, wait a minute. Yeah. It was really where de Kooning lived in my building. He was upstairs along with Esteban Vincenti and Milton Resnick. So we were the only four people in the building. But 10th Street at that time was really one street, and it was absolutely amazing. All the people that were there, they were all older artists.
Duchamp was near there, wasn't he? Duchamp was on 11th Street, I think, until the 60s, or had an apartment there at one point.
Oh, really? No.
Yeah. So, but I've heard that about 10th Street. So, and I want to talk about the influence of some of these people on you, but you're saying all along 10th Street there was kind of an artist community there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They all lived in the lofts. The lofts were like $50 a month. I mean, I had a loft. The toilet was in the hallway. I had no hot water. It was a very, you know, that's the way everybody lived at that time. You threw your garbage out on the corner. And a lot of the older artists were there. They always talked about art. I mean, you'd meet them in the street and you'd sit on the stoop and discuss art. And then there were four or five galleries on that block. I was part of the Eaches Gallery. And people would go to the openings and you would have talks. It was an amazing time. I wish I realized how amazing it was. I was very young. I didn't realize how lucky I was. And I didn't take any pictures of people. I didn't do any of those things. But I'm so glad I had the opportunity to meet them.
Yeah, that's an amazing opportunity. So let's talk a little bit about how that formed your thinking, because, you know, in the late 50s, it was an incredible time for artists in New York. I mean, so many names like the ones mentioned, William de Kooning, Vicente, and others were, and Milton Resnick were painting. But there weren't many women also at that time painting. And here you were among them. So I'm curious to know about how that went, how they perceived you, and also how
you were. Well, it was interesting. The only woman artist on that block that I can remember was Pat Pasloff. And she was involved with Milton Resnick. I think they eventually got married. I don't know if they did. Anyway, they were living together. Pat Pasloff had a studio across the street. She was the only female artist, and she was a lot older than me. And I was just a kid. But these older artists were, like, very sweet to me. I mean, they talked to me. They didn't look at me as a little kid. I had a lot of conversations with them. And I don't know. It was just really wonderful. So I was very lucky. And the point is, at that time, I had just graduated from Pratt. I met Jack Twerkoff. And Jack Twerkoff changed my life because he became my mentor. And I studied with him after I graduated from Pratt. And it was the first time I went into a studio in the Village, into Jack's studio. And he was just really quite marvelous as a teacher and as a, you know, he opened a lot for me, because I grew up in the Bronx, and I didn't even know who Picasso was when I went to Pratt. I went there because I liked to draw. I don't even know how I got in. And I thought I was going to go into advertising, of all things. But I met Jack in my senior year, and he just opened me up. And he saw possibilities in me, and he wanted me to work with him, and which I did. And
so tell me a little bit about that, because that's fascinating. That's a kind of a classic mentor relationship, right? He's looking at your work and opening your eyes to new worlds.
I'm going to tell you another story, which is very interesting.
Yeah.
My freshman year at Pratt, Calvin Albert was my teacher in foundation year. And he asked us to do a project of doing animals. And I did this, a dog and a cat in the dentist's office. And I remember Calvin Albert looking at it, and I thought he was literally going to throw up. It was so bad. I didn't know anything. Believe me. I don't know how I got there. And I looked at him, and I realized, this isn't going to happen again. I got to learn. And the interesting thing, about 10 years later, I got a phone call, and the person on the phone said, "Are you Hildur O'Connell?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Oh, I'm Calvin Albert. I just saw a painting of yours in a show, and I want to come to your studio to see what you're doing." And the reason Calvin Albert remembered my name, I think, was that I was so bad that when he saw this painting, he said, "This can't be the same person." Isn't that amazing?
Oh, that is amazing.
It really was, and we became friends. And I was on 10th Street at that time.
Wow, so that, of
course,
speaks to what's happened during that whole time. And
I know.
And what did happen between those paintings? What was the influence that brought you to a position where your painting was maturing like that, if that's not too big a question, because I'm interested in the influence of... as you're saying, those mentors around you.
Well, Jack Turkoff certainly was my great influence. He helped me a great deal. And so studying with him, and I remember going to his studio the first time. I'd never been in a studio before. It was on the Bowery. He had a huge painting. It was very abstract. It was all blue. And I remember looking at it, and it was the first time I really saw an abstract expressionist painting, really, although I heard about them. And I kept looking at it as he's talking to me. I was fascinated by it. I was so excited by looking at it. It was like, I don't know, like a whole new world opened to me, you know? It was just great. You know, a girl from the Bronx who didn't have any art education or any background or nothing. I was very lucky.
And then after that, of course,
you
continued your studies. So you're on 10th Street. That was after Pratt. And then you
And then when I was on 10th Street and I decided I was going to be a painter, I worked part-time as a waitress. I went back to school and studied art history. And I became fascinated with art history. That's when I got involved with the manuscripts. But I only studied art history to know more about painting, because I didn't know much about it. I didn't know that eventually I would be a teacher. I never thought about that. After I went to NYU, years later, then I went to Yale, and when I graduated, I was going to go back and be a waitress and paint. But then somebody said got me a job in a school teaching, and he said, and I said, "I don't know anything about teaching." He says, "Oh, it'll be easy." I was going to take his place for a year. But I was ready to teach art history. I already studied it. So I went to that school. I was supposed to be there for a year. I was there for 40 years teaching. And I loved teaching. I loved it so much because it taught me so much from the students. I learned from them. Different ideas, and I did a lot of studying, constantly studying, for lecturing. And I never thought that would happen to me. It was all happened spontaneously. Never thought it out.
Amazing. And so during that time, so you're teaching, do you remember your first shows? Because that's still a time when I would think it would be difficult. As you know, I've talked to other women that were exhibiting or trying to exhibit in that time, and it wasn't easy to get exhibited. But that's exactly when you began. Exhibiting.
Well, actually, when I was on 10th Street, I got into a gallery right across the street from where I was, the Aegis Gallery. It was a co-op. And I was there for a number of years. And so I was able to exhibit there. And that's probably where Calvin Albert saw my work. I don't know. I don't remember. And then later on, I just showed in different places. I never belonged to any real gallery because one of my problems is I can't be told what to paint. In a gallery, if you're in a regular gallery, they want you to sell. And I can't work that way. I have to work on my own. So I could only be in co-op kind of galleries or galleries where there's no obligation to sell. I had a couple of commissions to do paintings, and I went crazy, and I hated it, because I can't do this what I want. I mean, I can't work that way. I can't work with that responsibility, you know. But I always was lucky. I was always in shows. I continued and sold a little now and then, but continued working.
Well, that's an interesting point to bring up, how commercial galleries, depending on what galleries they are, can give this kind of pressure to sell.
Yeah.
So because of that, and to keep your independence creatively, did you seek out nonprofit spaces to show in? Was that
yes.
part of it, or cooperatives?
Yes.
That was how you continued
yeah.
to show?
Yeah. You know, and I have a group of painters we meet once in a while, and we have shows. You know, yes, I could not be part of a gallery. I cannot paint to just sell. I just can't do that. Mm-hmm. And so I never could be part of that world. And
yeah, that makes sense, of course.
I don't know if that's good or bad, but anyway, I know that's the way I feel.
Well, I think that's what artists need, to be free, right? To do what it
yeah.
is that you want to do. But that's, sometimes more elusive for some than others. And it's wonderful that you were able to do that. Was there a time, I mean, now you're working with, as you say, text and language. Was there another time, perhaps recently, between what we've been talking about and now, where your work took a big shift in terms of how you were approaching it?
My work today, wait a minute, sorry, I don't hear that.
In terms of the past to now, or in terms of, you know, the last 20, 30 years, were there times in there where your work suddenly took a big shift? Now it sounds
like
the work...
Oh, well, before
I
started working with language, I painted in many different styles. It was amazing. I mean, I was very figurative for a while. Then I got into... very much influenced by Rothko, where I was really studying color, and my work became very abstract. But I was always back and forth with abstraction. But when I realized that my fascination was with calligraphy, and that remained, and that's maybe for the past 20 years, I've been really more or less on that subject. And it grows. There's so much to learn about it. It's so interesting, you know.
Well, yeah, let's talk more about that, because the way you're approaching now the work and the text that you began talking about at the beginning, it sounds like your research is often books or schools of thinking. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. The car went
by. It sounds
by.
Like it, that's okay. It sounds like the work that you're doing now relates to... often literary issues or books or ways of thinking. Is that one of your primary inspirations or places that you draw from?
Well, I don't know, not really. I mean, I read a lot, and I read and I study. Like, I really study development of Islamic art, the Quran, Coptic art, African art, different kinds of images. And I read about that, and I'm very interested in primitivism, and especially being in art, being involved in art history. I read a lot of art history of different periods, which influences my work. And but I'm particularly love is the calligraphy. I love doing calligraphy. When I work standing up. It's a lot of action painting. It's very physical. And moving from one thing to another. But I do actually do lettering when I do my collage on a smaller scale, different kinds of lettering, which I use in the collage. So I use different kinds of medium, but I look at different languages and the history of those languages, which interests me. And also, I read a lot about the creative process and, Eisenzanger, that's how the hidden order of art. You know, art, nature is not as we think it is. We live in the uncertainty principle. Nothing is as it seems. So everything is mysterious. So we don't have any answers to anything. Everything is not clear. And that's exciting, which gives us free will, you know, not intellectual oppression. One of the things I found teaching, and I was teaching in a very analytical school, of a Jesuit school of very scholarship boys, all boys. Very analytical. No risk-taking. Everything had to be by the rule. They had to have the right answer, etc. And I tried to destroy that in them, if I could. Some of them would take art. I took them to a Rauschenberg show, because we were really near the Metropolitan. Some of the students went 3 or 4 times on their own. They were so excited by Rauschenberg. They'd never seen anything like that before. And I would give them projects where they would use all kinds of chance ideas, try different ideas. And they loved it. And I saw them blossoming, growing. It was beautiful to watch. It made me love teaching, because it was opening up these very bright, rigid kids into a new world. And also was, for me, an opening of a world.
Right.
You know, I love it. I miss, I'm not teaching anymore. I had to give it up because my voice was not as strong in my lecturing. But it was a very, very fruitful time, a growing time. And dealing with kids who had no artistic background or thoughts, who all were going to go into be lawyers or doctors or whatever. And to see them open up and feel free, they and see their excitement, it was wonderful. So.
And you mentioned your love of your love of calligraphy that's always been happening.
Yes.
Is that continues to figure into your work, I would imagine, as well?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I love it. I love to do lettering and calligraphy. It's beautiful. I mean, using very free form, being very free. I'm not rigid. I'm not a rigid painter. And so it's wonderful. So I use a lot of calligraphy. I use an awful lot of different things in my painting because what has happened to language, for instance, when you think of prehistoric times, it was pre-logical. It was not logical. It was free. It was mystical. And eventually we come to the 19th century with technology, where technology destroys language because it has to be intellectually oppressed, totally oppressed, because it is now used for mass media and advertising. And that's one of my objections to what has happened to language, the loss of the freedom and the beauty of language for commercial reasons. And this has happened in our education. Our education deals not in art or the intuitive process, but in analytical rules, following rules, don't break the rules, risk. All of that is so destructive in our society. And today, now with the computers and all kinds of machines, children, early children's life is on a primary process where they use their imagination and intuition until they become analytical. Then that's destroyed. But today, with the computer, I see kids now not using the primary process, but now on the computer. They're losing that early stage of creativity, which I think is a danger to our society, a real serious danger. Because you gotta use your intuitive sense. Look, I'm not against intellectualism. I think reason is important, but it has to be along with intuitive thinking. They have to work together. But in our education, they don't want intuitive thinking. You know? They don't want taking a chance and a risk of something new. That is very dangerous. And as a teacher, I found it horrible. You know? Really. So, anyway.
Well, that's also, I mean, that brings us back to the beginning in a way, because also how you're working is in a very intuitive way in terms of taking risks and not having everything planned or sketched, but to let the work speak to you and have a dialogue with it.
Yeah, it is. I mean, something interesting. Something said to John Cage, asked him in his musical score, "Is it a fixed? Do you have a fixed relationship of parts?" He said, "Of course not. That would be insulting." So it has a random, spontaneous feeling, not fixed or analytical. And I'm really against this fixed analytical approach, which dominates our society. Dominates totally, not only in education, but even in early childhood now with this computer stuff. You know, I'm not a computer person. I have a computer, but I'm not technological. But the computer is good because you get information. But I don't think you get knowledge from the computer. When I was studying art history, when I was doing research, I spent hours in the library with all kinds of books, not looking for one idea, but many ideas. And a computer is just, you'll get a fast solution to something. That's not learning. That's not knowledge. And that's what I'm concerned of. What is the future in education? I know.
I think that is a good concern, of course. And it's been wonderful talking to you. I'm about to ask you the last question about what you're reading now, but is there anything else you want to add or mention to the listeners before I ask you that question? Anything I should have asked or didn't ask that you'd want me to ask?
No, I mean, I just have all these old books that I've had over the years that I go back to, and a lot of them is on the creative process and primitive art and stuff like that. I don't really read novels very much. Although I love Joyce, so you know reading Joyce is very difficult, but look what he does in language. He creates it. He's an alchemist of the word, you know? I mean, I want to just tell you very quickly, when I was very, very young, and I went to Ireland, and I was going to be in Ireland alone for a while, I was going to paint there in my mother's hometown. I brought Ulysses with me. At that time, Joyce was not allowed in Ireland. He was banned in Ireland. So I had Joyce, and I'm reading it in Ireland. I went back years later, and finally, Joyce was now allowed. And I went to the library, and I saw Ulysses, and I thought, oh, there's Ulysses. I opened the book, and each page, somebody deliberately cut out words. Each page. It was unbelievable. You couldn't read
it. So
it was
censored. The book was censored, essentially.
That's right. So they were, somebody cut out one word after another on each page. Can you imagine that?
Incredible.
So the thing is, language has to be free. It has to be spontaneous and poetic. Poetry destroys language in a way of being static. It's being creative, dealing with the unconscious. And that's what it should do. And that's what art should do. You know.
Hilda, it's been a pleasure talking with you. I want to thank you so much for talking
to me today.
Okay,
pleasure talking to you too.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.